I'd like to welcome you all to the latest version of our Global Health Perspectives podcast. My name is Derek Yach, and I'm the president of a foundation for a smoke-free world. And we've been talking to a wide range of people starting at the beginning of the pandemic. And we've really addressed health, tobacco, and the issues that intersect often with COVID-19. Today, it's my special pleasure to welcome Mike Cummings. Mike is professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and a member of the Hollings Cancer Center Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the Medical University of South Carolina. Mike has been known as a true expert in the field of tobacco control from many perspectives, always with a very strong emphasis on addressing the science, whether it's related to products, consumer perception, behaviors, and policies. First of all, Mike, a very warm welcome to you on this rather chilly evening as we start heading into the winter months.
Well, good afternoon, Derek. It's great to be here with you, and it's nice and warm down here in South Carolina, so one of the advantages of moving south.
Well, let's hope you don't get badly hit by the hurricane that's now easing its way into New Orleans again. So let me just start by asking you, given which has obviously been a long career as an expert witness in litigation against the tobacco company, which I imagine requires incredible insight into the depth of the science, what led you to actually take on the tobacco industry in this way? And what do you think that some of your efforts have led to over the last few years?
Well, first of all, what led me into it was, basically working in a cancer hospital all my life. I mean, I worked at Roswell Park Cancer Institute up in Buffalo, New York. I was in charge of their tobacco research program. I ran clinics for smokers. I could see how they were struggling to quit and not being successful. I could see the consequences, not only for the patients, many of whom actually worked with me to speak to young children about their experience and so on, but also with their families. And so there was a personal part of it. And then doing the research that I was fortunate enough to be able to do with grants that I was awarded from the National Institutes on Health, when I was approached in the mid-1990s, basically, to help with litigation, I offered to do it. And I offered to do it for no money. Actually, it was Stanley Rosenblatt down in Florida who signed up lots of experts, people that you probably know, Derek, Ron Davis, talked me into doing this, David Burns, actually one of the former surgeon generals who I got to know, I didn't know at the time, Julie Richman, but he actually is the only surgeon general that I know of actually testified against the cigarette companies. He did so in the Engel case. I didn't know what I was getting into, but certainly was acutely interested in wondering why smokers struggled to quit, why kids were still taking up cigarettes. That interest in research, which I thought I knew a lot about, as the documents became available in the 90s, initially through some lawsuits happening in the Northeast, actually in New Jersey, Rose Cipollone, I started to get an education. And that just made me more curious. And I don't know, I guess tobacco litigation is addictive.
Well, I saw it at the time when I was at WHO, and we were just starting the work of the Framework Convention while the Minnesota case was winding down. So we had the benefit of Michael Cerisi and Roberta Welburn guiding us to do the first and only inquiry into any industry by a UN agency when we were shocked at the document's detail of how they'd subverted WHO policy over the years and who they'd subverted with what strategies and what policies. In fact, that was very important for the framework convention to have behind us as we went into the negotiating process. And as we started going through it, we also realized what was going to be needed was some means to evaluate whether the policies that governments put in place had an impact. And that's where you also stepped in with the establishment of the International Tobacco Research Policy Evaluation Project, what we might call the ITC project with Geoffrey Fong and others in the early 2000s. I'd love to know what you saw as the intent and the importance of it was. And now that we're 15 years after the convention's been in effect, what have been some of the major findings in terms of being able to evaluate policies of countries?
Well, one of the things that got us started doing it, I mean, to be honest, Jeff was right over the river from where Buffalo was. And I was introduced to Jeff and learned that he was doing research on health warnings. Of course, Canada was the first country to put on graphic warnings on their cigarette packs. And Ron Borland, at the time from Australia, was doing a sabbatical there. And I said, gee, we ought to do a study to see whether these warning labels make any difference. You know, here we are with cigarettes without the warnings. They had the text-based warnings buried on the side of the packs, and they had the graphic warnings in Canada. And Australia was getting ready. At that time, there was a good likelihood that they were going to adopt graphic warnings. And so that was the genesis of the study. Gerard Hastings from the UK came on board to help us understand a little bit about tobacco marketing. And we realized in order to do, cross-country comparisons, when we started looking at the scientific literature, almost all the literature was based on economic studies. They were not very rigorous. And so we proposed to do longitudinal studies in different countries that were adopting different policies at that time. In 2002, we pitched this idea to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And Nancy Kaufman actually was the person who took a risk on us. And we said, the framework convention was being discussed at that time. The opportunity to be there before countries started to implement different articles that eventually became part of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. But it was still in jeopardy. It wasn't a reality in 2002, but we wanted to get the baseline set. And they gave us $1 million. We launched surveys in four countries, adult smokers, Australia, Canada, the U.S., and England. And then we were able to be frugal in our data collection. Back then, you were doing phone interviews for the most part. And we were able to get them done and save enough money to do a follow-up wave. And we did that in 2000 to 2004. And we were well positioned at that time to make an application to the National Cancer Institute that was funding tobacco centers of excellence. They had already funded six. They were all focused on smoking cessation and genetics, not really finding a lot that was going to change population smoking. And they selected us. Actually, we scored tops in the next round of the center grants, and that sort of helped us establish ITC. We expanded it to Malaysia and Thailand, interesting countries. Malaysia had privatized cigarette industry, whereas Thailand, it's still government run, but Thailand had actually very strong policies related to smoking. So what did we learn? Graphic warning labels do prompt people to quit. They don't really make people quit. There's a difference between the factors that motivate cessation and what actually impacts people's ability to quit and stay off cigarettes. Price, big driver. Probably the biggest because it has the widest impact, and price matters. We all know that with anybody who goes out to buy a car. And, if you're not looking at the sticker price, then you're Donald Trump, I guess. So, you got to pay attention to the price, and that's certainly a big factor. Clean indoor air laws. were just coming in. So we rode many countries and localities implementing those laws, and were observing the effects it had on smoking behavior. There were an array of advertising and marketing restrictions going into place that we developed a lot of the evidence base using between country comparisons and within subject ability to track over time before and after policies went into effect.
And I think if you now fast forward to some of the recent evaluations, it's clear that price probably remains the strongest single determinant, but unfortunately it's not applied as strongly as it should. We don't have it in effect in all the countries yet around the world. But one of the issues that was not focused on much was not the population measures, but the need for adult cessation, as well as in the last few years, harm reduction. And I wondered whether ITC has turned its mind or focused at all on whether cessation programs have an impact, not at the general population level, but among adults. Are they seeing any perceptible impact?
They do have some impact, but they're limited. Again, the key factor for a daily smoker is they become addicted to nicotine, and it's hard to quit once you're addicted. And most smokers, as we know, are trying frequently to get off cigarettes, but not with a lot of success. If you follow over time, eventually, you will find more and more success, which is one of the advantages of having a longitudinal study. That's part of my reason in interest in cigarette products. Got my dog behind me here.
This is the Zoom reality. We welcome all sorts of animals.
Anyway, she's a non-smoker, by the way. But she does like bones. The focus on the addiction is something I've been involved with, and Ron Borland, we both sort of came out of running cessation programs. I mean, I set up the New York State Smokers Quit Line and ran that for 10 years and ran many clinical trials looking at various treatments, including the nicotine replacement therapies and other medications. And, while they have some impact, they're not great. So I was very interested when e-cigarettes came around, and the ITC project began to pick it up in our studies. People were using it, and we didn't have very good measures. We didn't know how to measure. We still don't know how to measure very well, to be honest with you. The products are evolving so quickly, and how people use them often depends on what product or what multiples of products they might be using. But it was a main interest of our team. We've now got a program project funded through the National Cancer Institute that is helping us, study the impact of alternative nicotine products and the evolving nicotine marketplace, which now is moving into heat tobacco products, which are old tobacco products. I mean, they were around in the 80s with Premier, and then later in the 90s, Eclipse, and Accord was a battery-powered version of IQOS. Obviously technologies have improved. And those products we've been tracking. Now, whether they are going to be absolutely good substitutes for cigarettes, I'm not really sure. I mean, it's very clear that e-cigarettes, for at least some smokers, are a partial substitute for cigarettes. And that's pretty exciting, actually, because NRT never fit that bill. Nicotine replacement therapy.
Yeah, and it seems that they're not just a substitute, but they seem to be becoming more successful means of actually completely quitting than the patch and the gum. I mean, certainly the Cochrane reviews and others from Europe suggest that's a more effective way to quit than through the patch and the gum.
Yes. I mean, absolutely. I mean, the Cochrane review, the recent review, 2 weeks ago or whatever, I think is very important. And it states what we're seeing in primarily the clinical trials is the combination of the vaping products and the evolution of those products seems to be outperforming NRT and literally replacing it. That's what we see in the U.S. and England, not as much in Canada and Australia, where The stop smoking medications still are the most commonly used therapies. But in the U.S. and England, I think smokers have recognized they've tried the NRT products. They don't work very well. And they're moving to the other products as a way to get off cigarettes. And unfortunately, we're doing everything in our means, it seems, to make that difficult, which, drives me crazy.
Well, yeah, and that's something I'm keen to know whether, again, it's something can be evaluated. It seems that the perception of risk sits at the cornerstone of whether the smoker is going to try an alternative product, but it also sits at the cornerstone of whether doctors will prescribe and policymakers will support. Certainly, our own data has shown that a greater proportion of populations now believe that nicotine is the major cause of cancer than in the last few years, and this seems to be hardening. In the face of that being so important, how do you think you overcome it, particularly in a low-middle-income country where these products are often banned, leaving the combustible on the market?
Well, I think policies could go a long way. I mean, at one point, I think Canada had proposed a very logical policy, which was to create some standard government statements that manufacturers could then use. This is safer than a cigarette. This is not to be used by non-smokers, things of that nature. But that's not been adopted anywhere. In the United States, we have a very clunky system requiring every manufacturer to go to the FDA and, show the FDA what the effects of changing a few words in an ad or on a warning will do to consumer behavior. And while those studies are immensely interesting, taking 2 or 3 years, we got 500,000 people dying from smoking, is just not the way to go. I mean, we have an urgent problem. Cigarettes are deadly when used as intended, and the vaping products are measurably, probably 90-95% safer than a cigarette, and you can go to the oral tobacco products as well. I mean, there's now tobacco-free oral nicotine, which, if you're concerned about vaping things into your lungs, I'm concerned about that as well and anxious and read the scientific literature. But there are alternatives out there, and the government, has, responsibility, I think, to let the public know about the alternatives. Now, doing that within a regulatory framework is complex. The FDA is dealing with an outdated law. So some of their clunky decision-making, I think, has to do with the Tobacco Control Act that was passed. And when you go globally, you get different policies in every country. So it's complex.
Yeah, because you've sat in the cessation world and you're looking at the growth of the harm reduction world. Do you think that there's any sort of push now from the progress being made on the e-cigarette tobacco company side to get out of the combustible market for the pharmaceutical companies to jack up their ability to give us better products? Because there's been very little innovation on the cessation side in the last 20 years. Or do they just not see that as a market they want to play in?
Yeah, I mean, competition is key. I mean, I wrote an article a long time ago, over 20 years ago, called Capitalism as the way to solve the tobacco problem. In other words, if you got people competing for lower risk products. At that time, I think I was writing a commentary about an article that I had reviewed for addiction that was doing the innovative process in some Scandinavian countries of making nicotine replacement therapy available over the counter. At that time, those products were still prescription only. In other words, you could only get them from the doctor. And so then you had to go see a doctor. You had to have a doctor assess, which is great if they're willing to do that. But that all costs money. It all takes time and effort. And with smokers, you want to give them an opportunity to act on their immediate impulse to get off of cigarettes. The best way to do that, by the way, we could talk about messaging and perceptions certainly make a difference. Perceptions about light cigarettes, which I think is why people are so concerned about allowing misleading messaging out there that could direct people in the wrong direction, because that was certainly harmful. But actions speak louder than words. And so manufacturers can get out of the cigarette business. I mean, I would love a cigarette company to announce that they want to, you know, stop selling cigarettes and are going to get out of that business, and they're going to urge their customers to go to the alternatives. In fact, I find it, as somebody who spends a lot of time in court testifying against cigarette companies, you know, I find it unconscionable and unethical for them to knowingly continue to sell a product that is killing one in two long-term users. I mean, the documents, you know, are very clear, demonstrating their knowledge of that, the importance of nicotine, and the ability historically, actually, to have alternative products. You can go back into the 60s and find internal business records from companies that said, if you want to stop the diseases caused by smoking, you know, make a product that smokers don't have to inhale into their lungs, or take the nicotine out of the product.
Yeah, and I would completely agree. I mean, I think the discussion at last is moving towards how do you get rid of all the combustibles and fast as possible. Our own index ranking the top companies shows that Swedish Match has now got 44% of sales coming from reduced-risk products. A huge leap ahead of the next one, which is Philip Morris at about 19%, or 50% in East Asia. The question is how you get all of them to move up. And as you say, competitive forces are one thing, regulatory pressures are other. But I do think that having that clear vision that this is a desired path, and public health leaders to call and demand and push it could actually make, we could get more progress.
Well, I like your index. I've read the report. I think it was an idea I actually suggested a while ago. So I'm glad to see, I'm sure others have suggested it as well, but I was glad to see you put that together. But I've got another idea for you. You might want to consider...
We're all listening.
Yeah, you might want an index on governments and ranking the governments and what they're doing. Because I think there's got to be competition there as well.
Yeah. No, I think that is something really critically important to think through. And I'm surprised that, you know, our colleagues on the Bloomberg side haven't actually started doing it. Because, you know, in the index, you can already see that you've got state monopolies, the Chinese, the Thais, the Vietnamese, and so on, who account for half the worldwide cigarettes, not really making a move at all. And these are governments who've signed on to the Framework Convention. So that is something we will take. And yes, you're right. I mean, that early capitalism article really was something about competition, was something that I remember reading when I was looking at the nutrition index, still at PepsiCo when it got launched, to do the same, rank food companies to highlight their obesogenic issues and how they can remove them. That was one of the reasons why we thought this may be a way to go. And the attraction is to the investors, the institutional folk, and to the companies.
Well, I think you've hit on it, because I've become increasingly convinced that the key group to target with what would move the market are the investors. As long as the investors and the money stays with cigarettes, we're not going to change very much. Yeah, but when the investors begin to see the handwriting on the wall and really dig down into where the money's going to be 5 and 10 years from now, you know, I don't think it's going to be in the combustible cigarette business. In fact, you can already see the money flowing away from that, even though the companies quarter to quarter look amazingly profitable. I mean, their overall ability to maintain that over 5, 10, 20 years is going to be severely limited. And as I, you know, I've heard from the lawyers, they've asked me this question. They said, well, Dr. Cummings, what would happen if we got out of the cigarette business? Wouldn't somebody else just come in to fill in the niche? And I said, well, that's possible, and maybe even very likely. But you wouldn't be sitting here defending your client, because they wouldn't have the liability that they should own that keeps the price up. I mean, if that companies actually had to pay the price for what cigarettes really cost governments and humanity, They would be enormously expensive. And as we started off, price makes a difference. And we've been playing around at the edges on the real price of cigarettes, around taxation and so on. Even in places like Australia, where we say, oh, they've got the highest taxes, and certainly it's had a big impact on depressing cigarette sales. We should be, you know, charging $100 a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, or thinking as well about how we're seeing the decarbonization of companies being stimulated by putting corporate taxes against the companies who are lowering their dependence of carbon. So there are people who've said, well, what happens if the corporate tax was actually linked to the proportion of sales going into reduced risk products? Lower the tax or increase the tax if they don't make progress. I think that'd be kind of a stimulus for many companies on the positive side, or they would reduce their risks they'd be required to. Let me just jump to one last question, Mike, and that's really about the future of tobacco control. And both of us have been in this game for many decades. So many of the people you mentioned, Gerard, Jeff, Ron Borland, we've been around for decades. What worries me a lot is where are the young, bright, new people actually picking up a lot of the new issues that are arising, whether it's from harm reduction or the use of IT and so on. Are we doing well enough to groom the next generation? And I'm particularly worried when I start reading about young people writing about the polarization they face in their career, having to make a choice on the one hand between going into what might be a harm reduction world or another into the more traditional and being penalized on their career prospects. How do we start thinking about and how do we foster excitement back? Because I do think we had a greater deal of excitement in the 80s or the 90s when we jumped into these areas.
You're right. And I worry about that as well. It's been highly politicized, in terms of different camps, the anti and pro smoking harm reduction camps, which I think certainly is affecting, the interest of young people coming into the field. I think there's interest there. I think they bring enormous talents around mobile technologies and the new technologies. But there have been real barriers, mainly about access to government funds. I mean, we have government agencies that have policies that, although not hard and fast, they make it very clear that if you partner with a manufacturer, even one that's not making cigarettes, by the way, just if they're in the vaping business, don't come knocking on our door. And they make that clear, by the way, not only to junior investigators, but to the senior ones also. And that is a very chilling thing. And I it's one of the areas that I'm most concerned about and feel like with FDA, I mean, here they're funding a huge amount of science. But much of the science, which, it's as good as you can get. They've funded very good people. But it's almost completely disconnected with the products that are going back to the FDA for their review. And so we have sort of a private secret research program where companies are going out and having to, sign up investigators, and mostly in the private sector, to do their research. Academic, folks are completely outside the process. And that's because FDA set it up that way. They didn't encourage and open up the doors for the research to move forward. And I think that's stifled a lot of action. I mean, my gosh, COVID in the United States, Project Warp Speed, okay?
Yeah.
Billions of dollars tossed, like literally many billions of dollars to pharmaceutical companies and academic researchers. I mean, at my institution, all the immunologists stopped doing what they were doing and started to focus on, new diagnostic tests and, the therapeutics around COVID, which is a very concerted effort. Imagine if we would do that around smoking. And it was government endorsed to do that kind of partnership. FDA, CDC, they ought to be doing that.
Yeah, and I think it reminds me always of Bill Foege's famous quote, that we mustn't let the urgent crowd out the important. And our pandemic of smoking is identical to COVID. It's just that it's in slow motion. And so we don't see the peaks and troughs. They're the same. They're actually bigger. Mike, let me thank you enormously for your wisdom and your words and thoughts. And I hope we're going to obviously be able to continue to make progress. And just to people listening, please contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And remember, as Mike reminded us, we are still in the middle of a pandemic. It's going to be tough for the next few months. Please keep your mask use. Remember to physically distance and stay safe. And again, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.